Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 69, The Power of Yeast Genetics.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today, we're going to talk about yeast genetics. We have Malcolm Whiteway, who's the group leader of the genetics group, the Biotechnology Research Institute, the National Research Council of Canada in Montreal. He also spent 5 years teaching yeast genetics at Cold Spring Harbor, which is one of the premier places to really pick up a technique in depth and to bring it back to your lab. And it's a really brilliant place to learn. So I encourage anybody who ever gets a chance to take a course at Cold Spring Harbor to do it. And Malcolm's experience doing it is really a testament to his the energies he's put into understanding yeast and using it as a tool.
Also, and his willingness to spend summers in Cold Spring Harbor. You know, not everybody's willing to do summer in New York.
It might be a little too warm for you, too. You're used to the Montreal summers.
Exactly.
Our guest host today, I've invited Vincent Ragnaiello, who's a professor in the Department of Microbiology at Columbia University and host of This Week in Virology. And I thought it'd be fun to bring in somebody who's got a lot of experience in molecular genetics in microbiology as well to help with the show. Welcome, Vincent.
Hey, Mark, and hello, Malcolm. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Just before the show, we were talking about qualifying exams, and one of the funny stories from my qualifying exam as a PhD student was that Malcolm was on my qualifying examining committee, so in the Department of Biology at McGill, and he was sitting at the table, but at the end, right, and all the other professors were facing me, and he was in the back. And at one point, the question was asked, so Mark, what's the gene name for the UDP glucose-glucosyl transferase in yeast? Which is what the kind of thing they ask at a PhD qualifying exam. And I was like, I don't know. UDP glucose-glucosyl transferase in yeast. And Malcolm's back at the back of the room, Cree 5. And Jen,
good for him.
I'm just whispering it. I'm like, thanks, Malcolm. So he helped me get through my PhD qualifying exam. Maybe, perhaps, had he not.
Well, that was a terrible mistake, I guess, ultimately.
You know, millions of dollars of grant money invested in my research. Maybe it was we'll see. Only time will tell. So I did my PhD just one bench away from Malcolm's bench in the lab at the National Research Council in Canada. And I was always impressed by his depth of knowledge of yeast genetics. And we've covered a little bit with Dave Thomas in a previous show, but really, it'd be really great if we could learn a little bit about yeast, because you can't get through genetics without having a deep appreciation for yeast and some of the tools that it brings to the table. So let's start off with the first question. What is yeast? Maybe very basic.
Well, yeast is it's actually, of course, just the generic name for, when we talk about yeast, we're talking about Saccharomyces cerevisiae, but there are thousands of different organisms that you could call yeast. Generally, a yeast is an organism that's a unicellular organism that grows by budding. It starts off as a sort of a roundish cell, which a smaller thing pinches off and grows, sort of like a balloon swelling up at the side of another balloon, and then the two cells separate. So yeast is a general class, but yeast geneticists basically deal with the organism Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is often called the brewer's yeast or the baker's yeast. It's the organism that makes your wine and beer and bread. So besides a research tool, it's a useful thing to have around.
How long has it been a research tool? Because I know we've used it for many, many years to make bread and alcohol-based drinks, but when did people start using it seriously?
Well, some of the early work, I guess, was in the 30s, Lindegren and people like that who basically started turning wild yeast into a laboratory tool. One of the key characteristics of the sort of the natural yeast is a trait called homothallism, which is the cells ultimately work from the Herskowitz lab identified the molecular basis for that. But the consequence is that yeast cells switch their mating types and mate with themselves. So they immediately become diploid. And so that is not a trait that's very useful in a genetic organism. So one of the early advances in the whole field was to identify what are called heterothallic organisms that lack, as it turns out, a particular nuclease called HO, which is necessary for the switching process. So locking the cells into one of two mating types, the A or the alpha mating type, was a critical step in sort of turning this thing into a useful genetic tool. And that was done in the early part of the 19th century.
So as it's much better to have a haploid organism where you only have one genome?
Well, the advantage of yeast, well, one of the advantages of yeast is that it functions well as a haploid organism. So if you want to do a genetic screen and identify mutations, you can do that. But you can also very readily turn it into a diploid by mating it to a cell of the opposite mating type. And we, at the yeast course, one of the great tools of yeast, the awesome power of yeast genetics, people think is the ability to do site-directed disruptions of genes. And because that's such a cool technology, you can take a strain, you throw in a piece of DNA, and you now have a mutant strain. People like to do it quickly, and they'll do it in haploids. We encourage them in the yeast course to always do your manipulations in a diploid and then trigger the meiotic process so that the cells divide into haploids. That saves you from accumulating mutations in a haploid background. It makes sure that when you do the analysis that the phenotype that you're following is actually linked to the insertion that you've created, and so that you know that what you've done is exactly what you think you've done. So it's actually a wonderful advantage of the organism to be able to readily flip between haploids where you can do screens and so on, and diploids where you can do more in-depth analysis.
It's good for us who study, well, not me, but for people who study yeast, but in the wild, does that confer any advantage to the organism to be able to go from haploid to diploid and back?
Well, in the wild, it mostly stays as a diploid, and one can see that it's going to be more resistant to genomic stresses and so on. So I think in the wild, the organism is only haploid for as long as it takes to find a mating partner, and generally that's part of the same ascus, so its mating partner is its sibling, as it were. So in the wild, you're not really finding haploid Saccharomyces. It had to be turned into a haploid that sort of exists in the lab.
So let's take this one little step back. Before we get in, like, just to give a brief definition of ploidy, it's kind of haploids or diploids. We're diploids. We have the chromosome set from our mother and father. And then Of course.
But your sperm are haploids.
Exactly. So that carries only one genome set. And I guess by only having one genome set, when you do disrupt a gene, you can't benefit from the genome from your other parent. So that exposes all kinds of Mendelian style biology. But yeast itself, why yeast and why not E. coli? What is unique to yeast? I'll let you go with that. How's that?
Well, I mean, the major difference between yeast and E. coli is that yeast is a eukaryotic organism like we are, whereas E. coli is a bacteria, a prokaryote. And so many of the characteristics of our cells are shared by the yeast. It has linear chromosomes with telomeres. It undergoes meiosis and mitosis. It has all the characteristics of a classic eukaryotic cell, which allows you to study those processes that you wouldn't be able to study in E. coli. So it serves as a great microorganism to investigate the whole class of eukaryotic organisms. You can't really say that it undergoes much in the way of development, so therefore you have other model organisms like worms and flies and so on that are wonderful genetic tools as well. But at the cellular level, yeast is a marvelous organism to study fundamental cellular processes.
So in the essence, yeast is like a single-celled version of us.
That's probably a reasonable description, yeah.
It has a nucleus?
It has a nucleus, yes. It has DNA. It has mitochondria. It doesn't have chloroplasts, of course. It has 16 chromosomes.
As a diploid?
So, as a haploid.
Okay.
It has all other organelles. It secretes proteins through a secretory pathway that is fundamentally the same as a human secretory cell uses. It does higher level processing. It glycosylates proteins. It is an excellent model for a human cell. It's not perfect, but as a model is pretty good.
you talk. our engineer here sent me a little text message. You're talking about ASCII's.
ASCII.
Yeah. So we'll get into that. Don't worry. So here is an organism, right, that has much of the same biology, and it's an organized cell, not like a bacteria, which is just basically a plasma membrane and goo inside. Well, I guess that's a gross oversimplification.
Ooh, but you're insulting some people, yeah, for sure. The goo, I don't know about that. It does have an organized nucleus. It doesn't have a nuclear membrane, but pretty organized, Mark.
Oh, they're pretty amazing. Maybe the most evolved creatures that have ever existed, or is that the virus, the most evolved one?
But Mark, we wouldn't be here without bacteria. Look, see this sign here?
Yes, absolutely. They just invested, the American government, I think $150 million in sequencing our microbiome. That's the...
it's very important to know who your close companions are.
Well, and you and I, we're like 1 to 10 trillion cells, mm-hmm. but bacteria on us make up 100 billion, sorry?
Yeah,
it's tenfold more bacteria.
Our genome is a small fraction of the DNA that's a component of our sort of personal body, yeah.
So that makes us a parasite or a symbiont to the bacteria that we carry. We really have, what are those?
Symbiont, I think symbiont is a good word. Malcolm, do we have yeasts in us as well, don't we?
Not Saccharomyces particularly, but another organism, another yeast that we work a lot with, Candida albicans, which is a human commensal. Yes, we're, most of us are colonized by not just bacteria, but also by fungi like Candida albicans.
Do Candida help us in any way that we know of?
Well, that's an excellent question because it's a potential pathogen. If your immune system is suppressed and other things go wrong, you can get potentially lethal bloodstream infections from Candida. And I was at a meeting several years ago where somebody said, well, the way we can eliminate Candida as a pathogen is we can just get rid of it as a commensal. We'll treat everybody to clean out Candida albicans from basically humanity, and then we won't have it as a pathogen anymore. And I just thought, whoa, I don't know enough about what it's doing for me. I know that it could be doing something bad against me, but maybe it is a useful thing. Generally, I think we find that with the microbiome associated with us, if you unbalance it in one way or another, the things go bad. So I would not want to get rid of my Candida commensals anytime soon until I was sure that we could get rid of it and have no negative consequences.
It's always about balance, right? Because when you give people antibiotics and you disturb the balance of bacteria in their gut, they have problems. And
that's definitely, Candida is one of the problems.
So people sometimes or frequently get treated with drugs to get rid of Candida infections. And presumably this removes the symbionts in your gut, the Candida. Do we know if there's any consequence of that?
I think if you're being treated to get rid of a Candida infection, you're probably not that worried about the balance in your gut because you're at risk of dying from a systemic infection. So, and it's also clear that not everybody is colonized by Candida. I think numbers I've heard are around 70%. So I suspect that it's a minor player in our flora compared to some of the bacteria. I'm not a medical researcher, but I had opportunity once to sort of do a swab of mucosal surfaces looking for Candida. And was just amazed at, you could actually find Candida, but you found lactobacillus at such an amazingly higher frequency. It really opened my eyes to exactly what Mark was saying about the small fraction of us that's what we think of the human cells. There's an awful lot of bacteria hanging around.
I welcome our bacillus overlords.
Well, many babies have infections with Candida in their mouth shortly after birth. It's called thrush, right? And they pick it up from the mother going through the birth canal.
Absolutely. That's typically when people get colonized. And generally, it's the function of your immune system to keep Candida under control. And newborns have an undeveloped immune system and therefore are at risk for thrush. Fortunately,
So that's when you are colonized at birth and then it's controlled eventually and then you keep the Candida the rest of your life and then if you have some other issue later on, that's when it becomes a medical problem?
But exactly. That's sort of the norm. It's 70% of us are colonized that way.
Mark, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Sorry, no. The thing is, we should preface this that we've had some conversations before we aired a little bit, and some emails have gone back and forth. So it might be good to preface this. The reason why the Candida albicans question is coming up as this yeast pathogen is that Malcolm has spent a tremendous amount of time and effort using his knowledge of yeast genetics and the power of the tools of yeast genetics to really tackle some of the major important biological questions around Candida and, sequencing the Candida genome, which isn't necessarily simple. It's a very difficult challenge, annotating that entire genome, studying much of its biology. So how about we talk about Candida albicans as your research program on Candida albicans, what you're doing, what are the major questions you've been asking and attempting to answer and answering, and then we could go back to some of the techniques in yeast genetics and how yeast genetics has sort of played an important role to understanding or to developing some of the tools in modern medicine and our understanding of human biology. So as a kind of an outline, and to the people that have just tuned in, we're talking to Malcolm Whiteway. He's a group leader in the department or in the genetics group at the National Research Council of Canada. So how about we talk about why what is it about how? Oh, okay, let's start over. 3, 2, 1. We're not editing anyway. Yeah. But how close is Candida to Cerevisiae? And by the way, how close is Cerevisiae to humans in terms of genome and biology?
Well, those numbers are fairly flexible. What we tend to say in our talks is the distance between Candida albicans and Saccharomyces cerevisiae is around 200 million years, and it's similar to the distance between mice and men.
Okay.
So they're similar, but pretty different. Different enough that some of the fundamental ways they work are different. It's an intriguing sort of anomaly that Candida albicans has a slightly different genetic code than what is the universal genetic code. It reads a particular codon as leucine instead of serine.
Wow.
So it's you'd say, wow, that's quite a difference. But if you were looking at a Saccharomyces cell and a Candida cell under a microscope, as long as the Candida is growing in its yeast form, you would have a hard time distinguishing them physically. So they look a lot the same. And they're a long way away from humans in terms of, I don't even know when the earliest common ancestor of fungi and humans was, but it's way, way back.
But we're pretty close though, right? Cerevisiae, well, aren't we 70% homologous in terms of genes?
The Candida and Saccharomyces, you can easily see a clear correspondence between 70% of the genes. When you get to humans, yes, you can certainly find lots and lots of genes where you can say, oh yeah, there's the RAS gene of Saccharomyces, and there's the RAS gene of humans. And therefore, as you were suggesting at the start of the session, that being able to look at as interesting a gene as RAS, which is implicated in so many human cancers, to have a RAS gene which you can investigate its molecular and cellular function in a simple eukaryote is a wonderful tool. That's a particularly bad example, as it turns out, because what we learned from how RAS functioned in yeast didn't really directly let us understand what RAS was doing in human cells. But it had actually very important indirect connections to our understanding. So it's interesting to see similar important functions which are wired differently, and that's something that we pay a lot of attention to in our current work. But then there's lots of other things where it's fundamentally the same. You have a cyclin-dependent protein kinase under the control of cyclins, and sorting out how that worked in yeast got Lee Hartwell and Paul Nurse working in Schizosaccharomyces pombe Nobel Prizes, because it fundamentally identified how the cell cycle was controlled in all eukaryotes. And understanding the cell cycle, of course, has lots of implications in human disease, cancers, and things like that.
And I suppose by the fact that how long does it take to change a gene in a and to knock out a gene or put a gene into a yeast? It takes 4 days, 3 days?
Yeah, if you're you can I think you'd probably we would tell you at the Close Marine Harbor course that you should actually do it in a diploid and dissect. So maybe it's going to take you a week to run that cycle. not as Dan Burke, one of the teachers at the course would say, you know, you don't want to be doing punk genetics. You want to be doing real careful yeast genetics. So do it in a diploid, dissect, and take the extra time to get it
right.
Is
that the White Way rule, lab rule?
Well, yes, that's what I, awesome. I don't, not everybody listens to the lab boss, though. That's
right. But well, you taught me how to dissect ASCII, so we'll get into that. But so here's an organism that allows you to do genetics and modify genes and do really get into the genome within a week, but study fundamental biological processes like, I guess, cell division, right? And the cell cycle. Which if you went into a mammalian gene system, it would take much, much longer.
Yeah, right? There's so many more components. Yeast is generally kind of a stripped-down cell. It doesn't have multiple cyclin-dependent protein kinases. It basically has one that runs the cell cycle. So your ability to sort the story out in a simple organism is often easier than in... And then once you've got the basic pattern down, you can see how it's been modified and amplified in higher cells, which might have three or four cyclin-dependent protein kinases all active at different points in the cell cycle.
I've seen a couple of my colleagues now turn from Saccharomyces to Candida, and... So I guess the obvious question is, can you do all the same things with Candida that you can do with Saccharomyces that we've been just alluding to here briefly?
Fundamentally, yes. One of the key tools is the ability to take a piece of DNA, modify it in a test tube, and insert it exactly where you want into the genome of yeast that was developed many years ago, and you can do the same thing in Candida. What you can't do in Candida is put the organism through a haploid phase because it's an obligate diploid, as far as we know. That takes away all of the easy genetic screens that you can do in a haploid organism where you can say, well, I'm going to mutagenize and I'm going to look for something that's missing a particular function. If you're doing that sort of analysis in a diploid, you have a problem because you have to get rid of two copies of every function, and you don't easily do that just by randomly damaging the genetic information. So the molecular tools are fairly similar. One of the real problems or real missing components in Candida right now is what's called a plasmid, which is a free-floating, typically circular piece of DNA that you can introduce in and take out of cells fairly easily. And introducing functions on plasmids in Saccharomyces is wonderful. You can throw in the entire genome on plasmids and look to see whether overexpression of a given function causes a change in cellular behavior and so on. Not having plasmids in Candida is not crippling, but it does eliminate a number of useful tricks that are available to Saccharomyces geneticists. Amazingly, in Saccharomyces, what's called the centromere, the piece of DNA that defines the ability of a chromosome to attach to the spindle and get segregated at meiosis or mitosis. That's a tiny little string of nucleotides in Saccharomyces, and you can put a centromere sequence onto a plasmid and manipulate the plasmid just like a little chromosome. The the centromeres of Candida are much more complicated, and so far it has proven not possible to get them on smaller pieces of DNA that you can manipulate, although work in Judy Berman's lab she's doing some really kind of cool stuff with Candida centromeres. So those sorts of things. Basically, you can look at all the tools that are available in Saccharomyces, and if you don't have them in Candida, you say, well, we want them. You know, what do we have to do to be able to do the same technologies that we found so useful in Saccharomyces?
But in Candida, if you wanted to disrupt a particular gene, you could do it. It would just take longer, right?
It would. You'd have to do it. You have to do everything twice. And but yes, I say routinely, because I'm not actually doing the manipulations. It's people in the lab that do it. But we routinely knock out genes in Candida to study their function.
Is Doreen still doing Southerns?
We are basically a PCR-based lab now.
Oh, cool.
We don't. I don't know that a Southern blot has been run for many years.
I used to watch them being done, and it was a laborious way to verify whether the gene had been knocked out, because you'd now see that segment of DNA get shorter. You use radioactive probes, and it was a lot of work to knock out those genes.
The first evolution there was to get away from radioactivity to probes that were just a dye-based thing. And yep. But now, yes, we don't do Southern blots.
Awesome. Cool. Candida albicans. We're talking, if you're immunosuppressed, you're on, you've got HIV or any kind of condition that results in a immunosuppression. You really want to be careful, because this yeast kills, right?
If you get a systemic infection of Candida, or there are other fungal pathogens that are equally nasty, the numbers that you see are terrifying. It could be 40%. Even with proper treatment, you'll die of the infection. Now, of course, since you are getting this infection, you've got an underlying medical problem. You're mm-hmm. as you say, HIV infected, or undergoing chemotherapy for cancer treatment, and so on. So there are underlying complications, but the ability of a fungi, if it is able to escape from immune surveillance, to basically use you as a food source, it's pretty good. I mean, you see what happens when you get mold on a piece of bread. You just don't want to be that piece of bread, basically, and your immune system is making sure that you're not.
So was that part of the motivation for you to start working on Candida, that it was a medical problem, or was it also that it's an uncharted place to go scientifically?
I think both of those things. It's, of course, useful to be able to go to funding agencies and say, we are dealing with a real medical problem. Once some of the initial tools of Saccharomyces were introduced into Candida, there was quite an opportunity for people to say, here's an organism that does some cool things that Saccharomyces doesn't do, and they'll be worth studying. Your former colleague Aaron Mitchell is doing a lot of work on biofilms, which is a generically important thing for medical organisms, and Candida forms biofilms, and it's a major part of it being a persistent pathogen in the hospital setting. And so understanding that process is both interesting from a biological point of view. Here's something interesting that these cells do, but it also has direct medical ramifications as well. So I think most of the people that have made the migration, or at least partial migration, usually you'll find any one of these labs that is doing candida work after having done Saccharomyces work is probably still carrying on some yeast work.
Are you still doing Saccharomyces?
Exactly. Yeah. We still study signaling in Saccharomyces. What I would say to any student in my lab is if the process is fundamentally the same in Saccharomyces and Candida, you don't want to study it in Candida. You'll learn how that system works a lot better in Saccharomyces a lot faster. What you want to do is to look at the biological processes where there are differences, either because this is just not something that Saccharomyces does, like switch to a hyphal growth form, or something where you might have thought initially the cellular processes were the same, but as you investigated it, you realized that things were done quite differently in Candida and Saccharomyces, and therefore it's a great opportunity to illuminate how very similar organisms can actually solve, evolutionary problems in different ways.
Is there any value to putting genes among the two organisms to see if you can transfer unique properties, for example?
Well, in fact, our initial sortie into investigating Candida came out of exactly doing that experiment. Years ago, Charlie Boone, who's a well-known yeast geneticist, was a graduate student in Howard Bussey's lab at McGill, and he had created a library of Candida albicans sequences on a yeast plasmid. And I investigated what would happen to them. We were studying extensively at the time the mating pathway in Saccharomyces. And I investigated what would happen. It's almost the last experiment I've ever done. Investigated what would happen if you put random genes from Candida albicans into Saccharomyces and asked, could any of these genes influence the ability of Saccharomyces to respond to mating pheromone? And the result was actually pretty impressive. There were a number of genes that you took them from Candida albicans, you put them into Saccharomyces, and it completely eliminated the ability of Saccharomyces to respond to mating pheromone. So then we started looking at what were these genes, and they turned out to be kinases and phosphatases that were the Candida equivalent of the kinases and phosphatases that were part of the mating pathway in Saccharomyces. And they're, because they were from a different organism, they were actually interfering with the normal function in the heterologous host. So you can actually find out some pretty cool things about how cells work by doing that sort of mixing and matching experiment.
But also, couldn't you help figure out what are some of the key genes that are biologically important in Candida albicans and then use those as drug targets or at least understand how some of the drugs are working?
Sure. So that's definitely a strategy that people take. They look at, since for a long time now, we've had the complete collection of gene knockouts in Saccharomyces, and you could say, okay, it looks like this function is essential for Saccharomyces. Presumably, if we knock that function out in Candida, it will be essential as well. And if we have a drug that inactivates that function, we'll be able to kill Candida. It actually works not as well as you might have thought. The overlap in essential functions is, I think, maybe around 70%. So you'll find many genes that are essential in Candida are not essential in Saccharomyces. Some of that is covered because Saccharomyces, in its evolutionary trajectory, underwent a whole genome duplication and therefore currently has about 10% of its genes represented as pairs of genes. whereas Candida never underwent that duplication. So it, where Saccharomyces has two RAS genes, Candida only has one RAS gene. So if you've got two copies of a gene and you knock out one of them, the chances are the other copy will cover the function. So there's that aspect of it. But even beyond that, one of the genes in Candida that we knocked out many years ago was adenylyl cyclase, the protein that makes cyclic AMP, which is essential in Saccharomyces. And although it inhibits growth of if you don't have it as a Candida cell, you don't grow as fast as your wild type neighbor, as it were, you're still able to grow. So we would have said from studying Saccharomyces, oh no, this is going to be an essential function. But it turned out not to be in Candida. So if you were targeting that as a for antifungal drugs, you'd be missing the target. So our argument is you actually have to do the analysis in the pathogen, you can't just look at what you see in the model organism. It can direct your technology. It can direct your initial experimentation. But in the final analysis, you actually want to see what's actually happening in Candida, if that's what you're trying to kill.
I'd like to take a quick step back here, because what I think. Sorry to interrupt, Vincent. We've got a little bit of a lag, maybe a quarter to a half second lag between the three of us, because we're traveling to Petaluma and back. What I think is absolutely amazing is that here we are talking about, oh, take this gene in, put that gene out, take it in, put it out, test it, as if these were simple Lego parts, right? And you really have to take a step back and think about what kind of power you have on the biology of the organism to be able to really play God in a simple time frame. You know, if only we could do this with mammalian cells that quickly and that easily and have our answers. I mean, this is what's amazing with yeast. I never stop being amazed at just how much you can do. You're playing God with a really complex organism.
Well, I mean, it one of the advantages, of course, of these things is that the cell is the organism, which is not the situation with us. We're lots of cells. So we can easily transform a Candida cell or a Saccharomyces cell. And when we do that, we create an entirely new organism, which you couldn't do that with humans. You can't take a human organism and sort of transform it. You'd have to do it sort of cell by cell, and that's, as you mentioned, the number of cells, that would take a while. So that's one, you know, fundamentally very useful aspect of an organism, which is both a cell and the organism itself. Even fruit flies or C. elegans or other good models, you actually have to, you know, cause the event early on in the development of the organism to get sort of all the cells in an organism modified, whereas with single celled organisms it's the same event. You
amazing,
create
though.
The new cell.
Yeah, oh, it's Legos.
It certainly attracts people like me to those sorts of systems, because you have almost a mathematical rigor associated with the analysis. I mean, literally, now that we can sequence genomes at the rate that we can, you can literally say, I'm going to take this organism, this yeast cell, and I'm going to create a partner to that cell which has one of its nucleotides changed, and we can basically guarantee that every other nucleotide is the same, and we can study the fundamental change in the organism resulting from that single nucleotide change that changed one amino acid in one protein. And that is, I mean, it is amazing to think that you're doing that and not really sort of being amazed constantly that that's what's happening.
No, you got to be amazed by it. I mean, I'm amazed still. You know, I did my master's on in plant biotech, and I remember having a conversation with you when I was interviewing to join the lab. And this was a while ago, but, you know, it took me 6 weeks to get a genetic transformation of Arabidopsis thaliana, which is this little mustard plant. And I spent the summer in a greenhouse. My face was dripping in heat and trying to get, you know, this one transformant. Then I said to myself, wouldn't it be easier if I was just working with yeast? It's like studying the biology of complex genetic traits, or sometimes simple genetic traits with complex biology, right? Both ways. We're just talking here, but you're saying, well, knock this gene out, overexpress this gene, throw in a plasmid. It's just like a little chromosome, you know? It's single nucleotide change, right? Like that. And in your lab a week, in a lab that does punk research, maybe a day. Think about the controls you have to do if you don't do it right the first time.
That's part of the reason why it's better to do it in the diploid, because often the people that are rushing to get the experiment done aren't doing all the controls. So sometimes you, in the end, have to throw out some pretty exciting observations because they were unfortunately not properly controlled.
Well, Vincent might say that, well, you could probably add a gene or knock out a gene in a couple of days too in humans. As a virologist, he's seen some terrifying things.
You can certainly do it easily in viruses. And now it can be done in mammalian cells, of course. It's more laborious. It takes longer. But in the end, you know, model systems are wonderful, but you also need to explore less tenable systems that are involved in disease. And that's part of the reason why you've gone into Candida, I suspect.
Right? Absolutely. And I have to say, as a sort of card-carrying Saccharomyces geneticist, it has been quite an eye-opening experience to be working in a closely related but distinct organism, because some of the things that we did years ago in signaling in Candida albicans, in Saccharomyces, we identified components of a heterotrimeric G protein. So that's a very classic system for transmitting signals in eukaryotic cells, and it's how your vision works, your neurotransmission, and so on. And we found, in Saccharomyces, things work just the same. You've got a receptor that sits on the surface of the cell, and then you've got this heterotrimeric G protein that links to the receptor and communicates the information downstream through a GTP, GDP exchange, dissociation, reassociation cycle. And we were fortunate to sort of resolve what at the time was a big controversy in the mammalian literature, because we could show conclusively in the yeast system that it was the beta-gamma subunit of the G protein that did the signaling, and the alpha subunit was the thing that turned the signal off. And that was opposite to the way most of the well-understood mammalian systems worked. And so it created quite a stir at the time. And I would have said that we understood how fungal G protein mating pathways worked, because it was very clear. The biochemistry had said alpha subunits did one thing, beta gamma subunits did something else, and the yeast genetics completely supported that. The alpha subunit was the mirror image of beta and gamma, and beta and gamma were exactly the same. So you had a beta gamma and you had an alpha, and they did opposite things. Couple of years ago, just because we worked on Candida and we worked on mating in Saccharomyces, and a mating pathway was identified in Candida albicans, it just seemed like, well, we're going to have to do the equivalent experiment in Candida albicans. We're going to have to knock out the alpha, beta, and gamma subunits of the G protein and prove that they worked exactly the same as they did in Saccharomyces. That's what I didn't want to do it because it was so obvious that it was going to be just the same. They looked exactly the same. The organisms mated exactly the same with a few sort of interesting twists in the case of Candida albicans. There would be no reason to think that they weren't going to work exactly the same, and they don't work the same. And so I have to say my profound understanding of how the fungal mating pathway worked that I thought I had from this very clear picture that you got from Saccharomyces was not a deep fundamental understanding of the thing at all, because I cannot tell you why, in the case of Candida albicans, if you don't have the alpha subunit, you're sterile, as well as if you don't have the beta subunit, you're sterile. It's something we're interested in finding out, but it's not what I would have taken from our studies on the model organism. So it's good to use the model organism, like Saccharomyces, to direct you into questions of biological relevance, but you've got to actually go in there with an open mind, because it's quite often that the organism that you're expecting to have been well modeled has decided to do things a little bit different.
So what are the medically related questions about Candida that are important to answer?
Well, you want to, I guess an important area for research in Candida is actually the interface between the pathogen and the host. We do a lot of our work just with Candida sitting on a Petri plate, treating it very much like Saccharomyces. And there are some really interesting biological things to understand there. But ultimately, we're going to have to understand how the Candida cell interfaces with the immune system, how it, we've got some very cool movies of Candida, you know, in a competition with macrophage that are trying to engulf the Candida, and the macrophage can't do it because the Candida switches from the yeast-like growth to a hyphal growth, and it just extends this tube that eventually it overwhelms the macrophage. So so a question we want to, and one of the very first questions we started addressing when we started into the genomics of Candida albicans is what is this molecular switch that leads to the formation of hyphae versus yeast cells. And we learned by knocking out adenylate cyclase, for example, that cyclic AMP obviously plays a role, because if you don't make cyclic AMP, you grow pretty well as a yeast cell, but you can't make hyphae. And we have some other mutations which do the same thing. So that allows us to zero in on some of the pathways that are critical for this cellular process, which is itself essential for the organism to be an effective pathogen. If you lock it, some people will argue, well, making the hyphae is the pathogenic state. The experimental evidence seems to be that if you're locked into either being a hyphae or being a yeast, you're not as good a pathogen as an organism which has the ability to switch between the two states. So understanding how the cell knows that it should be switching between the states and how it controls that process. Those are questions that are of interest to the community. Questions about how biofilms are formed are that's fundamental for medical intervention, because a lot of problems arise when a Candida biofilm is formed on a catheter, for example, and then even though you treat the disease, it reoccurs because you get recolonized from the catheter, a biofilm version of Candida.
Biofilm? So is it Candida that formed the hyphae of Candida that form a film, like a polymer?
It's actually the hyphae, the yeast, it does, the cells excrete some sort of polysaccharide matrix and so on. So there's a whole lot of interesting things going on in the formation of these biofilms. And yes, they're, I think probably in nature, they're probably going to be more than just Candida, but you can grow a slimy film of Candida on various plastic surfaces.
Wow.
If you have dentures, you can get Candida biofilms and so on. So people are, once again, it there's a difference between what you're studying in the lab and what you probably have in the real medical situation. But people are modeling growth of these biofilms. What are the genes that are implicated in forming it and so on? And certainly if you can't make the yeast to hyphal switch, you're compromised in your ability to make biofilms. So
is the biofilm a problem for treating with antibiotics? Does it make the organism more refractory?
Absolutely. Hundreds to thousands of times more resistant to the standard antifungal drugs. And there aren't that many antifungal drugs. There's azoles, a kind of candens, and a few other things that affect membranes.
God, so, I'm thinking, I was worried about bed bugs.
Well,
I never really worried about Candida.
Keep your immune system healthy, and by and large, with we do have medical implications of Candida, even in people with normal immune systems. The vaginal yeast infection is typically Candida albicans, and a large fraction of the human population would just as soon not have to deal with that. So having sensible drugs to treat non-life-threatening but discomforting diseases is definitely a worthwhile goal.
So a drug that inhibits biofilm formation, for example, would really find great use in treating infections.
I think that if you had something that that dealt with biofilms that you could couple with some of the standard therapies currently, that would be a wonderful tool. And in our lab, when we think about drug development, we're focusing on trying to get synergistic drugs, things that work independently to nail the organism, because even a very useful drug like fluconazole, sort of a standard azole that you'd treat people with, it doesn't actually kill the organism. It just inhibits its growth. So then you depend on sort of the other components of the immune system and so on to get rid of the residual non-growing cells. And that's a sort of a guarantee for resistance, that you're inhibiting the growth but not killing a pathogen. It's going to sit around as long as it can, and anything that gets it away from being inhibited by your drug is going to allow it to grow, and therefore a resistant population will develop. So that's another area that many Candida researchers focus on is antifungal drug resistance, because clearly it's drug resistance is a common problem when you're dealing with microorganisms, disease-causing microorganisms, and being able to deal with resistant organisms is a constantly growing problem.
So let me ask you the hardcore biotechy question here. So you've got this yeast that's a budding yeast. It looks like a little soccer ball, and it's got like a tennis ball popping out of it, and then eventually it grows to the same size of the soccer ball, and poof, they split. So you've got the budding side of Candida albicans. But when it tastes blood, is it blood that causes it to go to the morphological switch? Oh
my God. It actually, one of the best triggers for the yeast to hyphal transition is serum. So
serum. Vampire yeast.
So it is a
poofed.
It is sort of scarily like, yes, it tastes blood and changes its form. It likes to be warm too, so it has to be warm blood.
37? Okay.
37 degrees and serum, and you can get almost quantitative transfer of the yeast form to the Heifel form.
Okay, so you've done this experiment where you probably did it 12 years ago, and it was probably done while I was there, and maybe I should have remembered and noticed. So you, because it's critical, you have a gene chip facility under the supervision of André Nantel. You guys work. No, André Nantel's a friend of Fib. He's a co-host, a frequent co-host and panelist. So you can search Fib, André Nantel, and find out a lot about his work. So you have gene chips, and you can throw on RNA that was made by the Candida albicans, find out what genes have been turned on and turned off. And especially since you guys led the Candida albicans genome project, you can now study the whole genome in action. What did you use gene profiling to determine what genes were activated during the morphological switch from budding to vampire yeast?
Absolutely. That was the first use of the chips, was to study that particular process. I have to say that I was expecting hundreds and hundreds of genes to change. As it turned out, there were a relatively small number of genes which their expression changed dramatically, many of which had been identified by sort of single gene analysis, people looking at northern blots and so on. So in the end, although we were able to add, few dozen new, clearly Heifel-induced genes to the lexicon. What you learned, of course, were not the you didn't from that experiment didn't learn the controlling elements of the switch. What you learned was the consequence of the switch, and many of the highly induced genes encoded surface proteins that were not necessarily fundamental to the actual change in form, but they just made up the surface of the Heifel cell. So what you want to learn is what are the genes that change. But once you've learned what they are, then you use them as the probe to figure out what are the things that control their expression, because it's the turning on and off of these genes, the machinery that tells you when and where to turn them on and off. That's the critical thing. The genes themselves just sort of represent markers of the change.
So it would also be interesting to know what part of serum is triggering that, right? Have you tried? See, this reflects my old time view of things. Have you tried fractionating serum to see what component?
We have not done that, but that experiment has been done with surprisingly sort of controversial results. Some people will say what the key thing that is in serum that's doing the trigger is glucose, but in other cases you say, well, you can't just trigger it by adding glucose, so it's more than just glucose, and so. Although it is a really obvious and theoretically simple question, the experiments have been done, and it's not as clean as you might think or like.
Yeah, it's probably more than one thing, and then that.
I think ultimately that's it. It's
soul.
It's a multifactorial.
It's the soul
thing.
Of the creature that it's invading as a vampire yeast. So, as Burke was asking, he's our engineer producer over at in Petaluma. He was asking, is it really called vampire yeast? No, it's not.
No,
it's called Candida albicans. I'm just calling it vampire yeast because it likes blood, and I can just picture it, sucking the blood through your veins and capillaries. It's just horrible. But it's an amazing system to one, validate and develop technologies like the gene chip. And you guys have made great use of it to not only study morphological switching and candida albicans, but you've been able to apply it to all kinds of cancers. And Andre's really, really taken that to the new level, which is a lot of fun. And also developing the manufacturing and utility and usefulness and ease of use of the whole next generation of molecular biology.
In the next generation, we won't be using chips. We'll be doing the direct sequencing of the DNA rather than sort of adding it to nucleotide probes on a chip. I think in the simple fungi, Saccharomyces candida, a chip is going to remain a really valid and valuable tool. And a lot of what we've been doing more recently is doing chip experiments, where you're asking where in the genome transcription factors are landing. And postdoc with Andre has just finished looking at the entire transcriptome of Candida albicans using tiling arrays rather than when we did our first arrays, we were lucky to have one probe per gene. Now, of course, people can generate chips where the probes cover the entire genome with a little bit of overlap. So you know that you're looking at every possible nucleotide in the genome at some point on your slide.
On one chip.
Oh yeah, because the genome of a yeast, I mean, it's 6,000 genes. These things are tiny, and they're also conveniently like little cDNA libraries. They don't have a lot of intervening sequences. They don't have a lot of intergenic space. So it's sort of, they're basically just a densely packed collection of open reading frames where you can see the ATG and you can see the termination codon. And it's, you know, there definitely are intervening sequences in a few of them, but not the majority. And so compared to, you know, a Drosophila genome or the human genome, where, you know, it's genes inside of genes, and then each transcript is spliced, you know, dozens of times. Looking at a yeast genome is trivial, because it basically has gotten rid of all of that complexity. It saved enough of it to have the machinery around so that you can study that process in a genetically tractable organism, but it doesn't interfere with your ability to annotate the genome. I just want to make it, if anybody from Stanford is listening to this and saying these guys did not sequence the Candida genome, we did. That's absolutely true. The sequencing was okay. Done at Stanford, sort of an international effort that was initiated by our group was to annotate and then to, in the end, assemble. But the core sequencing of the Candida genome was done by primarily the Ron Davis lab at Stanford.
Speaking of genetically tractable, this reminds me of something you mentioned earlier. You lamented the absence of plasmids in Candida. And I wonder, has anyone looked thoroughly in the environment? I don't know actually if Candida is in the environment, but perhaps you might find a plasmid there that might be useful.
Or in related species where you could, you know, get the plasmid out of the species and move it into Candida, even if it's not a natural component. Those are excellent things, and I actually don't know if people have made systematic attempts to identify plasmids in the Candida clade of organisms. I suspect efforts have been made, but I'm not aware of them.
Because as you know, the key to manipulating mycobacteria was to find phages or viruses of mycobacteria that infect them. And Bill Jacobs just went up into the Bronx and found them in soil. So it may just be a matter of going to the right pile of dirt and finding them for Canada.
Absolutely. And if I could get a grant to go look at dirt in some exotic southern clime, I'd leave a Montreal winter and go to the Bahamas to try to find Canada.
Actually, Hawaii, right? It must be done 100 miles off the coast of the main island. It's funny because we had a guest, Ed DeLong, who's a metagenomicist who goes out and sequences genomes out of the Pacific and just sequences the ecosystem. And he's out there looking at the genomes of bacteria that are 100 feet deep, 50 feet deep, 10 feet deep, and has come up with incredible models of genetics where genes are being transferred, not only between inside species, but cross species, and shown that, DNA jumps from organism to organism is pretty in quite an amazing way. But I asked him, why isn't he just not going to the puddle outside his lab in Boston? But he had a really good answer, and his good answer was that it's an ecosystem that was really, really, really well understood, and they could have all the reduce, I suppose, as many variables as they could. So,
yes, sure.
But it was
as scientists, we're good at rationalizing our desires, I guess, ultimately.
Right. Hey, before we go, because we're sort of running low on time here, I'd like to sort of get the bigger picture of how yeast has sort of helped humanity in terms of our understanding of ourselves, in terms of improving medicine. I suppose, we could talk about Randy Scheckman's dissection of the secretory pathway, or, how proteins get secreted and how the liver works and secretes proteins into the blood, and having dissected that whole pathway in yeast, which I think he'll win the Nobel Prize at one point for it. Or the crazy story coming out of the Garanti lab from episode 2 of Futures in Biotech, that was all done in yeast. And that is the discovering the sirtuins, right?
Yeah. I think I was just out for dinner last night with, Jack Szostak, who was my old, postdoc, supervisor. When I was a postdoc, I was with Jack, who last year won the Nobel Prize for telomeres, which all that work was done in yeast. And that clearly has...
He won because of you, by the way, Malcolm. It was work as a postdoc in the lab that pushed him over the edge.
I actually didn't have anything to do with telomeres. It was all essentially done before I joined the lab, and I was basically the first postdoc. So that just shows what quality Jack Szostak has. That's of clear medical relevance. It's of clear relevance for aging, for cancer, and so it was awarded for sort of a medically focused aspect of the study. Although the work that was done in yeast was not, they weren't really thinking sort of medical implications. They were really thinking how do chromosomes, how do they solve the problem of a linear end. And of course, the Hartwell and Nurse Nobel Prize for the cell cycle, so fundamental to our understanding of how the checkpoints and just what's going on in a lot of diseases. So you can go and as you say,
prions.
I thought when I first started in yeast, I was introduced to this bizarre element, psi, and I it was such a weird thing, and years later, when Reed Wickner said, "This is a prion, we understand it," I thought that was one of the coolest examples of somebody looking at a complicated... all the information was there, and it took a brilliant yeast geneticist to say, this genetic element has all the earmarks of a prion, and now there's a really exciting collection of research focused on prion-like elements in yeast. And of course, I always felt that a process like that, that was so bizarre, could only be really appreciated either in a system that was so well controlled as yeast, or so medically important as human disease, that you looked at it closely enough. In general, I think a biological phenomena like that, if it wasn't coupled to yeast or human disease, people would just say, "Oh, that's just too weird, and we don't have the tools to try to sort it out. I'm going to go on to some other question." In yeast, the precision was such that you could spend your life studying it, even if you didn't understand it. And in the case of, you know, prion-based diseases, well, these were lethal things, so we wanted to deal with it as because it was something that could kill us. But I think it's a reflection on the capacity to really, you know, eliminate spurious observations in an organism like yeast that allowed people to actually study something that could so easily have just been dismissed as an artifact.
Right. With a prion story, though, it's amazing for a number of reasons. One, it helped understand that proteins could be provide hereditary information passing from, you know, cell to cell to offspring, basically genetic information that was non-Mendelian in nature, right? That's just unbelievable. And some of the work that Susan Lindquist talked about on a fairly recent past episode, she discovered that these prions can act by sequestering transcriptional activators, act as a way to perpetuate evolutionary change or phenotypic change. And then you take it to the next level. She scanned the genome and found that there's, you know, a considerable number of them. And this is all done in yeast, right? And it's just because you guys are bouncing genes back and forth and you can do it in such a beautifully controlled way.
Yeah, I mean, people had understood the sort of the prion nature of diseases before we understood that Psi and Ura3 and things like that were the equivalent in Saccharomyces. But I think what it has done is generalized that type of epigenetic behavior and allowed us to see, wow, there's a lot of that going on. And even to expand beyond just thinking of it as a sort of a protein folding, misfolding phenomena, and even to see some regulatory circuits. There's a very interesting circuit in the mating behavior of Candida albicans, where a transcription factor that serves as its own activator, as it were, sets up a positive feedback loop that is stochastically broken by having the level drop or conditions change. But this was a bizarre epigenetic behavior. These cells would switch at a fairly high frequency from what was called the white form to the opaque form. And when that was understood, it wasn't a sort of a prion type thing, but it was at a certain fundamental level, a very similar process where equally stable but different states could rapidly flip from one to the other. So I think we can think of those phenomena. They're cool in their sort of just the protein aspect of it, but they represent an even bigger class of sort of switches that can be easily turned from one state to another to control, you know, entire developmental processes.
It's probably also worth mentioning that aside from these wonderful examples of how yeast studies have illuminated other systems, that many people have been trained as wonderful geneticists in yeast laboratories and then gone on to take those skills into mammalian genetics, for example. So kind of a broader donation to science.
It certainly is a wonderful training area for thinking about questions genetically, figuring out how to approach them. And I mean, in the era of genomics, we sort of think, okay, you know, this is a new environment. But in reality, a screen like the Sheckman screen for secretory mutants, or the Hartwell screen for cell division cycle mutants, that's genomics. You were taking a comprehensive look. Now you weren't as comprehensive as you could be now by knowing, you know, every open reading frame in the organism. But fundamentally, that's what you were doing. You were saying, I'm going to look at a cellular process and I'm going to figure out all of the genetic elements that are important for that process. And so that, it was no stretch at all for yeast geneticists to become yeast genomicists, because that's where they already were. You were just used to thinking, we want to know all the elements that are important for a particular process.
It's amazing. Well, that work where Sheckman, we're talking about Sheckman's dissection of the secretory pathway, the cell has this whole mechanism of machinery, a set of tools to make proteins and get them secreted out into the environment or to the cell surface. And that includes this. It's the same pathway that the CFTR, cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator channel, It's where it goes. It's where it's made and how it gets to the plasma membrane. So understanding the secretory pathway to the detail of understanding the players of that molecular machine was all done in yeast. And Sheckman just looked for fat yeast, right? He centrifuged yeast and did a centrifugation where you spin them down and the heavy ones go down to the bottom, the light ones stay on top, and looked for yeast that were fat, right? That had accumulated garbage inside them, you know, or proteins that couldn't get out, and then did, you know, classical yeast genetics looking for complementation mutants. Well, if I take this one and made it with this one, does the effect still happen or does it not happen anymore? If it doesn't happen anymore, then there's a good copy of each gene, so they're two different genes. So then he, you know, came out with, how many genes did he come out in his first screen?
I can't remember.
Like 100. Let's just say about 100, right?
I think the initial screen gave fewer than that. And then once they realized the sort of class of elements that they had, they came up with other cooler, interesting ways to find other mutants. So the search was initiated by that screen and then expanded in other ways to identify more and more secretory mutants. Yeah, I think I would have said 17 or something in the very first publication.
It's amazing.
I think that work is wonderful, because then all of the individual components of that pathway, which he called VPS genes for vacuole or protein sorting, they were then identified in mammalian cells, and very similar pathway. And then we figured out how viruses co-opt that pathway, in particular HIV-1. And there was a very close collaboration between yeast labs and people working on this problem in HIV. And it all started in yeast. So it's a really nice example of how the problem was sorted out in yeast. Sorted. And then we use that information to, no pun intended, to figure out how a virus gets out of the cell.
But that's a complex genetic trait, right? And it's a whole molecular machine machinery that made up of hundreds of components that does one biological or just a handful of biological functions. It's just an incredible. But if you flip it on the coin and look, do what Lenny Granty did with Cerevisiae, he looked for yeast that survived a very long time, right? Identified single genes that could greatly expand the lifespan of the yeast. Then took those genes, looked out to a number of genomes, and then found, well, those genes exist in fruit flies. They exist in C. elegans worm. They exist in mice. They exist in humans. And from that work, Sertris, which was bought by GlaxoSmithKline for $700 million, and they're developing drugs to delay the onset of diabetes, Alzheimer's and cancer, with the side effect of potentially extending the human lifespan to 120 years. And it's because Lenny Granty looked for yeast that lived longer and was able to map out the genes that did it. There was, so I think it's
yeast. I find, I mean, I still have to sort of be amazed that those correlations are maintained between between yeast. I mean, the idea of looking for yeast that gets old, that's really very cool, right? And then saying, oh, look, we do have these elements that affect the lifespan of yeast. I was perfectly content with that. I thought there was no way that those elements would be influencing the lifespan of multicellular organisms, because one sort of looks at them and says, well, you know, a cell that is the organism, it's going to have a different way of sort of controlling its lifespan than a multicellular organism. And I have to admit to being completely astounded that there is maintained this correlation between some of the things that trigger extended aging in yeast, like calorie restriction, and the fact that that works in higher organisms as well. And I think it is, you know, we're an interesting species. We've learned biologically that if we starve ourselves, we should be able to live longer, but we'd prefer to take a pill and
still. Well, you have to starve yourself. Well, you really do. Well, it is severe starvation that will allow you.
That's the joke, right? You don't actually live longer. You just feel like you're living longer.
Exactly. Well, it's a boom or bust evolutionary concept. If you're in an environment that has no food, you want to delay the breeding of that organism to a point where food then becomes available. So life as a whole, it's a general trend. We've been able to, all organisms have been able to maintain those essential genes that allow us to live through a bust period. And then when the boom period comes, we're still fertile. Amazing story. And we found out because of yeast, right? We found out how it works because of yeast.
Well, It's not clear necessarily that it's actually working the same way. I mean, we do have those sorts of situations where, and a perfect example was RAS and cyclic AMP in Candida, in Saccharomyces in Candida. RAS regulates cyclic AMP production. So people figured, well, sure, RAS is going to regulate cyclic AMP production in mammalian cells, and it doesn't. It's the same circuit, and it's connected to things differently. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done to figure out at the molecular level how elements like the sirtuins mm-hmm. are controlling the behavior that we see, and to know whether increased aging in Saccharomyces is at a molecular level doing the same thing as aging in human cells. One of the things that people have found about the aging in Saccharomyces is a big effect of acetic acid, and it's unlikely that it's the same function in human cells. You know, maybe it's lactic acid, I don't know, but so there's it's an area where there's still, as in all areas, I guess, still lots of opportunity for some good experimentation.
I have one lingering question which I would like to ask you, and we've talked about how if you're immunosuppressed or infected with HIV, you have a problem with Candida. Has anyone looked at the candidiome, let's put it, in individual people to see if there are any variations that might explain colonization in certain people and not others?
Right. So that's a very interesting question, because clearly some people, not even necessarily immunosuppressed people, but some people are more susceptible to vaginal yeast infections than others. What is it? Is that a function of their immune system, which, you know, seems to be normal, but we don't, you know, it's a complex system. So maybe there's some differences between people, or what's going on with the different Candida species. It turns out that their Candida can be divided into a whole variety of what are called clades. And they're sort of geographically distinct. Clade in Africa, North America, and so on. But within those populations, the variation within Candida is not that great. So I don't know if anybody has been able to pin down sort of polymorphisms which define different levels of virulence in Candida. But there is a lot of, because it's a diploid organism and it sort of only very cryptically undergoes any sexual cycle, it's basically a clonal thing. And a lot of variation has arisen over the years just by accumulation of errors. And since you're a diploid, you can handle a fair amount of polymorphism, it seems. and therefore, I think it even with the level of sequencing that we can do, it's not a trivial exercise to take a highly polymorphic organism and pin down exactly which polymorphisms are important for behavior. But the technology is developing to the point that those sorts of experiments will be done, I'm sure.
Now, the fact that there are clades suggests that there's adaptation to different populations, so that could
or that,
also
that they just arose. Apparently, it's not an area that I'm at all familiar with, but apparently you can sort of follow human population dispersal by looking at the the flora, because it's been hanging around us for a long time.
I really appreciate you you coming on the show, Malcolm. You taught me a lot about genetics, and it's really great that you could share it with the Futures in Biotech audience.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, this is sitting in front of a computer screen and talking away. You can get me to do that anytime.
What's amazing is how we're just, and we let it get to a fairly high technical level here. And this, Vincent and I really enjoyed that. And I hope it translated okay to the general audience, but it doesn't matter, because once in a while you have to do a show for me and for Vincent, and that's what it was really about today in part. And it was really great. The simplicity of the system is its beauty, and the what you guys have done and how are you able to play with it is just amazing to me. Every time I think about it, you're just...
It's a lot of fun to work with. That's for sure.
And it smells good too. I noticed when I walked into that lab for the first time, I opened the incubator and it smelled like warm bread. It was amazing.
Compared to an E. coli lab, which doesn't smell like warm bread,
they stink.
You're absolutely right.
They're doing great work, but they stink. I'd also like to thank Vincent Ragnallo, who's the host of This Week in Virology and This Week in Parasitism. He is also a professor at the University of Columbia. I encourage you to go over to twiv.tv and find out more about his work. Thank you, Vincent, for coming on the show.
Hey, always a pleasure. Love doing it. And nice meeting you, Malcolm.
It was a pleasure as well. Take care.
We did a show, by the way, with Dick Depomier, and Vincent co-hosted that episode of Futures in Biotech. And we talked about a book that was coming out. Vincent, would you like to show the book?
Yeah, so this book is called The Vertical Farm. And it's by Dixon Depomier, my colleague on TWIV and TWIP. It was just published this week. And this is all about the problems we're encountering producing enough food for everyone, and how his vision of producing food in skyscrapers might solve it. So it's on Amazon. It'll soon be on Audible, too. So check it out, Vertical Farm. There's a nice quote here on the cover by Sting at the very top. Sting likes this concept, and he might make a movie of the first one to be built.
That's amazing. That'd be really great to have his support on that project. It's pretty cool. So check it out on Amazon.com. I'd like to thank the crews that made this possible. Burke McQuinn for handling the audio and video and recording today in Petaluma. I'd also like to thank Leah Laporte, Lisa Cancel, Frederic Louis, Ken Shepherdson, Tony Wang, Mike Taylor, John Salina, and the rest of the team in Petaluma. I'd also like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can email me at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv or on Twitter at mark, M-A-R-C, P-E-L-L-E-T-I-E-R. One question I'd like to pose to the FIB audience is, would you like to hear more panel episodes where we discuss various topics in biotechnology and the future of technology? We're considering doing more and doing 50-50 with guests, having many guests come on the show. Let me know at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.